The golden age of radio is on the air. Morehead State Public Radio presents classic old-time radio programs from radio's golden age, the 1930s through the 1950s. On this program of the golden age of radio, baseball legend Babe Ruth is a guest on Bill Stern's Sports Reel, a Kentucky Derby broadcast from 1940, and Lon Clark reads from the Sunday Comics as the Comic Weekly Man. Stay tuned for the golden age of radio after today's news from NPR on WMKY at 90.3 FM. Welcome back to the Golden Age of Radio on WMKY at 90.3 FM. Later on today's show, Brian Field has a Kentucky Derby broadcast from 1940, and Lon Clark reads from the Sunday Comics as the Comic Weekly Man. Right now, baseball legend Babe Ruth is a guest on Bill Stern's Sports Reel from 1946, as WMKY presents the Golden Age of Radio.
C-O-L-G-A-T-E. Colgate presents Bill Stern
with a Colgate Shave Cream Sports Newsreel.
Bill Stern, the Colgate Shave Cream Man, is on the air. Bill Stern, the Colgate Shave Cream Man, with stories rare. Take his advice and you'll look keen. You'll get a shave that's smooth and clean. You'll be a Colgate brushless fan.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. This is Bill Stern with a 333rd edition of the Colgate Shave Cream Sports Newsreel, featuring strange and fantastic stories, some that are legends, others mere hearsay, but also interesting. We'd like to pass them along to you. Our guest tonight is the most famous baseball player of all time, the one and only Babe Ruth. But first, real one. Portrait of a strange beginning. This is a story that's so interesting that I'd like to tell it to you as it was told to me. This is the story of a hobo. Actually, he wasn't a hobo in the true sense of the word. His name was Harry. His family had given him a good education, but because Harry liked to roam and because he wouldn't stay home, he became a hobo as he drifted from one town to another. Shortly after the turn of the century, when our story opens, Harry had just run away from his home, and he found himself in Baltimore, Maryland. He was broke when one day on the street, he happened to find a dollar bill. A dollar to Harry meant a great deal. It meant food and a place to sleep. But then, suddenly, Harry remembered something else. He remembered that in a Baltimore orphan asylum was a youngster who wanted more than anything else in the world to own a baseball bat. Harry had seen this youngster the day before, and the youngster told Harry how much he wanted a bat. For a while, Harry thought about the youngster and how much that baseball bat would mean to him. And then, Harry thought about what he himself could do with that dollar he just found. He could buy a big, thick steak. He could get a place to sleep. Harry was torn between two emotions. He wanted to spend the dollar on himself, and yet somehow he kept seeing that pleading face of the poor orphan boy begging for the baseball bat. It didn't take Harry long to make his decision. He decided to go without food so that he might buy that baseball bat for his little friend in the orphan asylum. After that, according to the story, Harry drifted from one town to another until finally he found himself in Canada, traveling on a train. Only Harry didn't have any right to be on that train because Harry didn't have any ticket, nor did he have the money to buy one. And on the second day of that train trip, the conductor caught Harry. First, the conductor merely asked Harry where his ticket was. But when Harry couldn't produce either a ticket or the money to pay for one, the conductor ordered that train stopped, and he ordered Harry thrown off. After Harry was thrown off that train, he began to look around to see where he was at. He was 30 miles from the nearest town, and as he could plainly see, this part of Canada that he was in was wild and desolate. But Harry soon found out that food was plentiful and easy to get. So Harry decided to stay where he was, at least for the time being. One day, Harry made a curious discovery. For in searching for food, Harry discovered that certain rocks in the ground contained a brownish metal. Harry thought he knew what he'd stumbled onto, but he wanted to be sure. And after experimenting with those rocks, Harry was sure. He had discovered gold. Feverishly, Harry dug into the ground. The deeper he dug, the more gold he found. The Canadian government recognized Harry's claim, for he discovered gold on the spot where he'd been thrown off that train. And he became the second richest man in all of Canada. Such is the strange story of a former hobo named Harry. His full name was Harry Oakes. And his gold mine, which he did discover on the exact spot where he'd been thrown off that train, that gold mine gave him over $200 million. But remember when Harry was poor, when he was drifting around in Baltimore, Maryland, how the story said that he'd bought a baseball bat for a poor youngster in an orphan asylum? Well, that baseball bat inspired that youngster to take up the game. And this youngster liked the game of baseball so well that he went on to become the greatest ball player of all time, for his name was Babe Ruth. Babe Ruth will be with us in person in just a few minutes. Reel two. If I were to write the story of the colorful manager of the Pittsburgh Pirates, I'd like to call it Flashing Through the Years with Frisch, because that expresses the tempo of Frankie Frisch, known in his playing days as the Fordham Flash. Maybe Frankie would reciprocate with a piece called Flashing Through a Shave with Colgate Brushless Shave Cream. As a matter of fact, Frankie recently wrote me,
"Dear Bill, I always envy those kids with beards like Peach Fuzz who could shave so fast with a no-brush cream. But I never dreamed a brushless shave cream could soften my tough whiskers until you got me to try Colgate Brushless. Honestly, Bill, that Colgate Brushless Shave Cream of yours gives me marvelously smooth, comfortable shaves with all the speed and convenience of no brushwork. Thanks a lot. Signed, Frankie Frisch."
You know, the part of that letter that I like best are those three words, "thanks a lot." I think you'll say thanks a lot, too, when you try Colgate Brushless Shave Cream. This is the shave cream of champions. The brushless cream made specially for you men with tough beards and naturally dry, sensitive skin. This is the shave cream made to give you more shaving comfort, made to stay moist and active clear through your shave, made to soften the toughest whiskers so your razor can chuck up a snag-free performance. And remember, Colgate Brushless isn't gummy or greasy. Rinses off your face and razor in a flash. Look, take my tip. Try Colgate Brushless Shave Cream, and if you're not completely satisfied, just send the top of the carton to me, Bill Stern, care of Colgate, Jersey City, Zone 2, New Jersey, and you'll get double your money back. Okay? Okay, then get a jumbo jar. That's the big 9-ounce economy-sized jar of Colgate Brushless Shave Cream. Get it tonight. Reel three. Profile of last Sunday. Last Sunday was St. Patrick's Day. And because it was St. Patrick's Day, we're telling this legend tonight. For this is a St. Patrick's Day legend as told to me. This is the story of Stanley Ketchell. Stanley Ketchell was one of the greatest fighters who ever lived. He came blazing out of the West shortly after the turn of the century. He was rough. He was tough. In fact, Stanley Ketchell was one of the roughest fighters who ever fought in a prize ring. As long as any opponent stayed on his feet, Stanley Ketchell would tear into that opponent like a wild animal. He never showed any mercy to anyone. He was hated for what he did as he crippled man after man. Once in Cleveland, Ohio, on a St. Patrick's Day, according to the story, Stanley Ketchell fought an Irish youngster named Ernie Ball. Now, Ernie Ball was no match for the great Stanley Ketchell. And even though the fight was on a St. Patrick's Day and Ernie Ball was an Irishman, Stanley Ketchell proceeded to give Ernie Ball such a frightful beating that the youngster crumpled up on the floor in a bloody heap and he never fought again. However, it's really little wonder that Stanley Ketchell was able to beat Ernie Ball so badly. For Stanley Ketchell was rapidly becoming one of America's most famous prize fighters. He knocked out one man after another until finally, Stanley Ketchell became the middleweight champion of the world. Stanley Ketchell remained a ruthless fighter, even after he'd won the championship. A fighter who beat his opponents as badly as he could, until one day, at the very height of his career, Stanley Ketchell was murdered. The story of Stanley Ketchell's murder created a sensation. And after he was dead, the police went through his personal belongings. And in going through his effects, according to the story as told to me, they came upon a curious piece of paper. It was a letter written by Stanley Ketchell about a year before he was murdered. A letter that in effect read, "To whom it may concern. They've called me a ruthless fighter, a man without mercy." In most cases, that was true. Only once did I ever regret giving an opponent a bad beating. That once was back on a St. Patrick's Day in Cleveland, Ohio, when some of you may remember I fought an Irish youngster named Ernie Ball. And the only reason I'm sorry I beat him so badly is because I later found out that he wasn't a professional prize fighter at all. He was merely a youngster who was trying to get some money for an education. Thereby, I hereby direct whoever settles up my estate to please see that this youngster, Ernie Ball, gets $1,000. And I hope he uses this money for his education. Signed, Stanley Ketchell.
Ernie Ball did use that money for an education. He immediately came to New York City, where he began to study music until one day he wrote a song. A great song. The song became famous. So did Ernie Ball. And yet, according to this story, he might never have gotten to New York City. And he might never have written this song. But for a rough prize fighter named Stanley Ketchel and a prize fight that took place on St. Patrick's Day. But the strangest part of this story is that this song that Ernie Ball did write, as the result of a prize fight held on St. Patrick's Day, that song became famous as a great St. Patrick's Day song. For that song was When Irish Eyes Are Smiling.
Sure they see your
profile for great St. Patrick's Day song that, according to legend, began with a St. Patrick's Day prize. Reel four. In just a moment, we'll present in person the most famous baseball player of all time, Babe Ruth. First, Arthur Gary.
Why do so many great sports stars go all out for Colgate Brushless Shave Cream? Why? Brother, they've proved that Colgate Brushless delivers the maximum in shaving comfort with a minimum of time and trouble. You betcha. Smooth on this light, fluffy cream. See how it softens the toughest whiskers. See how it stays moist, doesn't dry out. Gives your razor a grand assist for a close, clean, snag-free shave. See how Colgate Brushless Shave Cream rinses off razor and face jiffy quick because it's not gummy or greasy. That's champion performance, men. It's what you can expect every time you use Colgate Brushless, the shave cream of champions. So buy yourself a jumbo jar tonight. And now, Bill Stern with his special guest, Babe Ruth.
Reel five. Colgate's camera close-up of Babe Ruth. Here is the most famous baseball player of all time, the one and only Babe Ruth.
Bill, may I ask some questions, please?
On what, Babe?
On the story you just told.
Well, go right ahead.
Let's take the first story, the one about Harry Oakes and me.
Okay.
Are you sure that it was Harry Oakes who left that baseball bat for me at the orphan asylum?
Well, Babe, I wasn't there. I can only say that that was the story as told to me.
And how about being thrown off of the train in Canada and finding a gold mine on the spot where he was thrown off?
Well, Babe, that story came from his own wife.
All right, let's go on to the second story.
Fire away, Babe.
Did Stanley Ketchel really give Ernie Ball the money that got Ernie Ball to New York?
Well, now, there are two versions of that, Babe. One version is that he was given the money by Ketchel. And the other version is he used the money he got from fighting Ketchel to get to New York.
But either way, it's amazing that a prize fighter should be responsible for the success of a tender song.
Yes, you're right, Babe. It is amazing. Now, if you don't mind, let me switch this around and ask you some questions. Who's going to win the American League pennant?
Why, the New York Yanks.
Oh, Babe, you might be prejudiced, but let's ask you who's going to win the National League pennant.
I think the St. Louis Cardinals.
Well, Babe, tell me this. What do you think of this new Mexican baseball league?
Why, it's mainly a lot of hot air.
Who's the greatest ball player playing baseball today?
Well, I think Ted Williams and Joe DiMaggio.
Who would you say was the greatest baseball team of all time?
I would say the Yanks of 1927, because on that team was Bob Musil, Tony Lazzari, Earl Coombs, Herb Pennock, and many others, and a good manager named Miller Huggins. And there was another player on that team by the name of Lou Gehrig.
Well, I
hope he is never forgotten.
Lou Gehrig was a great baseball player. But more than that, he was a great man. A man whose life was an inspiration to America. For on the day that Lou Gehrig died, a legend was born. No. He can never be forgotten. Thanks so much. Good luck and good night, Babe Ruth. And that's the 3-0 mark for tonight. Next Friday night, we'll be back same time, same stations with another edition of the Colgate Shave Cream Sports Newsreel. Our guest next Friday evening from Hollywood will be the lovely movie star, Miss Benita Granville. So be sure and be with us next Friday night at our usual time when we present as our guest the famous screen star, Benita Granville. See you then. And until then, I'll be seeing you on the screen in the News of the Day newsreel at your favorite Lowe's or Associated Theater. Now until this same time next Friday night when we greet you with our special guest, Benita Granville, this is Bill Stern for Colgate Shave Cream wishing you all a good, good night.
Bill Stern, the Colgate Shave Cream man, is on his way. Bill Stern, the Colgate Shave Cream man, had lots to say. He told you tales of sports heroes, the inside dope he really knows. So listen in next Friday night. C-O-L-G-A-T-E.
Ladies, your grocer would just love to sell you all the soap you want. Sure he would. But he can't do that right now because the country's shortage of fat is keeping you short of soap. That's why, ladies, you're asked to save your used kitchen fat. Save it and sell it to your butcher for 4 cents a pound. So fill a tin and turn it in. The Bill Stern Show tonight came to you from New York City.
This is NBC, the national broadcasting company.
Hi, Hap.
Hello, Ann.
How are things?
Couldn't be better. Except walking 12 blocks to your service station just isn't for me. You got my new spark plugs in?
Just finished putting those brand new Autolite resistor spark plugs in your car. Guess she takes a big load off your arches, eh, Hap?
Sure does. My feet have the pep, but not the pickup. What are you listening to tonight?
Oh, it's Thursday, Hap. I'm listening to the Autolite Suspense Show. Never miss it.
Well, here's where I rest my weary bones and listen to Agnes Moorhead.
Hey, Hap, here comes Frank Martin, the Autolite salesman, to join us. Hello, Frank.
Hi, Ed.
Meet Hap Horton.
Autolite spark plugs, batteries, and ignition systems.
The lifeline of your car.
And they're off, and it's a good start indeed, with all the way very fast indeed, and Bimelec gets one crack of the whip to make him come up there, but Mealand is being raced out to try and go with him. Roman takes the lead head-in-head with Bimelec, and the two are racing in this first quarter to see who'll get the track, and Roman gets it with Bimelec second, deep third, Mealand next, Galahadian in on the rail, and the whole lot of them under a blanket except for Roman. Roman leads by two lengths as they go past the first time. Bimelec in a good spot on the outside, going head-in-head with two others, the other two being Mealand and Galahadian. Those three are in a rank across the track. Within a length of the three there comes Adit, Sirocco, Royal Man, and Pictor. In that order, it's Roman on the head end as they make the first turn, and it's Galahadian second and Bimelec third. Galahadian is now being passed by Bimelec, and the favorite is a neck in front of Galahadian. Here's the call. It's Roman on the front end by two lengths. Bradley's horse, Bimelec by a half a length. Galahadian by a half a length. Deep by a length and a half. Mealand by a length. Sirocco by five lengths, Royal Man by a half a length, and Pictor. That's the way they go down the far side, and it's still Roman. Bimelec is not getting to him yet, and he is still on the outside in a good position. That boy is waiting, and I hope he don't wait too long. They're at the far turn, and Bimelec moves. There he goes. He goes up with the leader, and Deet goes right after him. Deet and Bimelec move to there together, and they seize Roman. They're going head and head with Roman as they go around the turn. Bimelec and Roman are moving up there together with Deet on the outside, and at the head of the stretch, it's still Roman leading, and Bimelec now in front by a neck by perhaps half a length, but he doesn't shake those horses off, and Deet is alongside of him. From far back comes Royal Man of all horses. It's Bimelec in front by half a length. Deet driving at him, Royal Man third, and Royal Man going like the wind on the inside. Royal Man head in head with Bimelec, and Bimelec looks as if he might get beaten. Galahadian moves up there rapidly now, and he's the one that's going to take it. Galahadian in front. Galahadian by a length and a half, and that's the finish. Bimelec second. Deet third. Mealand, Sirocco, Roman, Royal Man, and Pictor. And that's the finish of the Kentucky Derby with Bimelec beaten and Mrs. Ethel Mars's Galahadian the winner.
If I said a rose to you for every time you made me blue, you'd have a room full of roses. If I sent a rose of white for every time I cried all night, you'd have a room of roses. And if you took the petals and you tore them all apart, you'd be tearing at the roses the way you tore my heart. If someday you're feeling blue, you could send some roses too. I don't want a room full of roses. I just want my arms full of you. petals and tore them all apart, you'd be tearing at the roses the way you tore my heart. If someday you're feeling blue, you could send some roses too. I don't want a room full of roses. I just want my arms full of you.
You're listening to the Golden Age of Radio on WMKY with George Morgan and Room Full of Roses from 1949. We also heard a Kentucky Derby broadcast with announcer Brian Field from May 4th, 1940, and Bill Stern's sports reel featuring guest Babe Ruth, originally broadcast on March 22nd, 1946. Stay tuned for more classic old-time radio from the 1930s through the 1950s. When the Golden Age of Radio continues on Morehead State Public Radio, WMKY, at 90.3 FM. Welcome back to the Golden Age of Radio on WMKY at 90.3 FM. Right now, Lon Clark reads from the Sunday Comics as the Comic Weekly Man, as WMKY presents the Golden Age of Radio.
I'm the Comic Weekly Man, the jolly Comic Weekly Man, and I'm here to read the funnies to you happy boys and honeys. Yes, boys and girls, it's Comic Weekly time, and here I come right into your house to bring a little fun and happiness right out of the pages of Puck the Comic Weekly straight into your living room. Your friend, the Comic Weekly Man, the jolly Comic Weekly Man. Hello. Little Miss Honey, how are you today?
I'm fine.
That's fine. I'm fine, too.
That's fine.
Sounds like this is going to be a fine time.
It will be if you have a fine joke.
In the comics, we should find one.
Goody, please read me the funny.
Puck the Comic Weekly?
Yes.
I will in just a moment. But before I do, let's listen to this nice man.
Golly, what a wallop. He rang the bell again.
He's feeling his Cheerios. Yes, Cheerios, that energizing breakfast cereal made from oats. Good, old-fashioned, nourishing oats, all ready to eat. Cheerios gives you a kind of nourishment that really counts. Cheerios is a cereal that really helps you build up strength and energy. So for your better breakfast, always start with Cheerios. C-H-E-E-R-I-O-S. Cheerios.
Now, here we go with Puck the Comic Weekly. And at the top of the first page, there's little old Snookums.
Yes, but could we turn over the page to Flash Gordon? It's so exciting, I just can't wait.
Why, sure we can, because Zarkov, Flash's friend, has come in the rocket ships from Mongo.
Just in time to save Flash.
Uh-huh. And Zin had escaped with a machine by which he controls the zombies. And they were just about to overpower Flash when Zarkov came.
Well, I wonder whether Flash and Zarkov will capture Zin now, so let's please read.
Since you said please, we will read Flash Gordon. Rig-a-rig-a-doon-doon, Zaskamatash. Let's have music for Heroic Flash. Z- Tarkov has seen Flash on the ground below and has landed his rocket ship to pick him up. Safe behind a ring of flame, Flash helps the rebellious Rubio into the rocket ship. Flash laughs. Zarkov, old man, you landed just in time. Zin's zombies nearly got us. Quickly, they take off. They zoom to the volcano crater where Dale was hiding. As Flash steps out of the ship, Dale throws her arms around him, almost weeping with joy. She tells him she was afraid he was caught in the fire caused by the bombs dropped by Zarkov. Flash chuckles. Well, I did have a pretty hot time of it. Dale then sees Rubia, whom Flash has brought along. She asks what she's doing here. Rubia answers that Flash just couldn't bear to lose her, which makes Dale jealous. When Flash sees the two women beginning to argue, he frowns last picture top row. We've no time for such nonsense. Our job is to catch Zin and to get in the ship and take off. But the crafty Zin, first picture, bottom row, is too deeply hidden inside the moon to be found. He controls his slave army through the auto-brain, thinking for them, even seeing through their eyes when he chooses. He sneers to himself.
Flash, you're searching in the wrong place.
Then he sees that Flash is raiding his laboratory. But instead of preventing the men he controls with the machine from going within range of the dropping bombs, Zin, reckless of human life, sends his robots to certain doom directly into the area where the bombs are dropping, hoping that one man will live long enough to get to Flash. But Flash, from above in his rocket ship, sees the poor men marching into the area and being killed, and he orders, "Don't shoot the poor fellows. We'll use coma smoke."
Does that mean that he's not going to drop any more bombs?
That's right. Instead, he's going to use coma smoke, which the robots will inhale, and it'll put them into a sleep, which is a coma.
Oh, that's very nice of Flash.
Yes, that's what I thought, too.
Well, I wish he could find where Zin is hiding and get him so no more of those men will be killed.
Well, let's hope they find him next week. Well, now, how would you like to read Dick's adventures?
Oh, I'd love to, because Dick has been with Paul Revere in the early days of America. And remember last week, he and Paul Revere made a fast ride on horseback to a town called Lexington. And do you remember they were yelling, "The British are coming, the British are coming," and the people got out of bed in their nightshirts.
Yes, and right in the middle of this dream, Dick woke up.
Well, maybe he'll go to sleep again and have another exciting dream. So let's read, because they're so exciting.
Well, let's find out now. So here we go on page 3 with Dick's Adventures in Dreamland. And say the magic words with me.
Rickety-pack-a-zack-a-zick.
Let's have music for Adventurous Dick. It's nighttime, and Dick is falling asleep. His father hears him mumbling and says,
"I thought I just heard him say George Washington."
And then Dick drops off to sleep. And in his dreams, he goes back, back. And he finds himself knocking on a door. The servant opens it. And in answer to Dick's question, the servant says,
"Well, yes, sir, young gentleman. This is the George Washington plantation. Any name to give Mr. Washington?"
"Well, tell him, please, I was just sent down to Virginia from Massachusetts with some very important news."
Dick is led into the house and meets the great man himself. And last picture, top row, is telling George Washington,
"Sir, the British regulars and the American Minutemen have fought their first battle. It started in Lexington on the 19th of April.
And as Dick tells the story, George Washington sees it in his own mind, just as we see it in the pictures in the second row.
The Redcoats marched up from Boston to arrest John Hancock and Sam Adams in Concord and to seize powder and bullets. But Paul Revere rode ahead and warned everyone. And the Minutemen were waiting in Lexington, and they were shot down. And at Concord Bridge, there was another battle. But the British were too late to catch Hancock or Adams, and most of the powder and bullets were used on them. And then they started back for Boston."
And he goes on, first picture, bottom row.
"The news spread like wildfire. Bells were ringing everywhere. Farmers left their fields and workmen left their benches. And they came with their guns and blasted the Redcoats from behind every tree and stone wall. And they cut them to pieces."
And as Dick finishes telling his story, the servant comes into the room, followed by a tall, distinguished-looking man. The servant announces,
"Mr. Thomas Jefferson to see you, sir."
And as Dick sees the great Thomas Jefferson, the man who wrote the Constitution of the United States, one of America's greatest patriots, he exclaims, "Gosh!"
Oh, wasn't that exciting? The Americans chased the British back.
Very exciting, because the Americans were only farmers and the British were a large army.
Yes. I wonder what Thomas Jefferson has come to see George Washington about.
Next week, we'll find out.
Oh, I can hardly wait. You know, there's so many famous men in this story. There's Paul Revere and George Washington and Thomas Jefferson. I wonder who else will be in this story.
Well, if you'll be here every Sunday, maybe we'll find out.
Oh, I certainly will. Oh, look, here's Rusty Riley right below Dick's adventure.
Yes, he's back home safe and sound again after his exciting adventure, and he and Tex are talking about it.
Oh, I'd like to hear what they're saying, so please read.
All right, here we go with Rusty Riley. Gallop and run till the road is dusty. Give us music for his horse and Rusty. Tex and Rusty are sitting out in the barn in the tack room, which is where they keep the saddles and things. And Rusty is saying,
"Golly, Tex, it's sure good to be back here after that awful night in the quarry. Well, I thought Hillbilly and I were done for."
"Yeah, that sure was a rugged experience, Rusty. But it was right smart of you to notice them low-flying planes. You know, that's how we located you."
"Hmm. Well, by the way, how'd the police happen to arrive just at the right time?"
"Well, that was a surprise to Mr. Miles and me, too, Rusty. They just got curious when they heard where we were heading. Turned out lucky for them as well as for us. That hombre with the mustache is known as Blackie, a man they've wanted for a year."
At this moment, Mr. Miles comes into the barn and says,
"Oh, Tex, I'm glad I caught you in. And you too, Rusty. I have some business to attend to up in New England, so I'm going to open the old house on the coast. You and I will go there right after the Selby Cup race."
"Well, how about Patty and me? Are we going to go too?"
Mr. Miles replies, last picture, top row.
"Yes, yes, Rusty, we'll be there quite a while. So I've wired to have a tutor for you two youngsters."
"Right, boss. Well, we better send Jimmy up to get the stable ready."
First picture, next row. As Rusty's packing, he asks his little friend, Patty,
"Have you ever been up there, Patty? Where is it?"
Patty tells him that it's a wonderful place called Shark's Neck, and that he'll just love it, that there are boats and fishing and everything. Rusty's eyes light up at the thought of going to this wonderful place. Meanwhile, many miles away, on the New England coast, a cantankerous-looking old man called the Squire is reading the telegram he has received from Mr. Miles announcing that they're coming. And he says to himself,
"This telegram for Miles poses a bit of a problem. I might even say nuisance. Well, I better talk this over with the captain."
Last picture, he's down by the boatyard talking to a bearded old fellow who's a sea captain, saying,
"Captain, I have some disturbing news. Quentin Miles is coming up to occupy his house on Shark's Neck. This is a severe blow to our activities."
The captain thinks for a second, then replies,
"Well, Squire, it's true it has the only safe beach on the neck, but with a little care, we ought to be able to keep on without too much danger."
What does he mean, we ought to be able to keep on without too much danger?
I think they don't want anybody to know what they're doing.
Oh, but do you think they're doing something bad?
I really think so.
And Mr. Miles and Tex and Rusty are coming there?
Yes.
Uh-oh, more trouble.
I'm afraid so. And I think we'll find out something about it next week.
Goody. Now can we find out what's happening with Roy Rogers? He's in trouble, too.
Yes, you bet he is. He was on his way to help a friend of his.
And then he saw some wild horses running away, and he saw a man who was going to shoot one of them.
And Roy jerked the gun right out of his hand. Then a minute later, another of the crooks had flicked the lasso over Roy's head, and Roy found himself tied up.
So let's find out what the crooks are going to do to Roy.
All right, turn over the page. And there on the top of page 5 is Roy Rogers, King of the Cowboys. Hi-yip-hi-yo. Now here we go with Roy and Trigger. Hi-yip-hi-yo. His hands bound behind him, Roy watches as Beaker, one of the crooks, lassoes one of the wild horses, snags the rope around a tree, and holds the horse steady while he says,
"All right, splice the lariats together, Shorty. This wild Mustang's gonna give Rogers a joyride."
Shorty, Beaker's Mexican helper, ties Roy's feet to the end of the rope around the wild horse's neck, saying, "This'll teach you to mind your own business for good." And they let the wild horse go, last pick to top row. And he gallops off, dragging Roy on the ground behind him. Shorty shouts first pick to next row. "So long, Rogers! Watch out for the high spots! Ha!" As the horse that is dragging Roy goes out of sight down the canyon, Beaker and Shorty mount their horses. Beaker says, third pick to second row,
"All right, let's get back to trailing that critter. We gotta get him before Chubby Walden does."
Meanwhile, last pick to the row, Roy shouts to Trigger, who has followed the wild horse dragging him, "Stop him, Trigger, quick! Force him into the canyon wall!" Trigger gallops up and forces the horse against the canyon wall, stopping the horse. First pick to bottom row, Roy calls, "Keep him busy until I get myself loose, Trigger boy!" Quickly, Roy unties himself. The wild horse quiets down. And Roy climbs in the saddle and continues on his way, last picture, saying, "I aim to get even with those two polecats, Trigger. But first, we gotta find Chubby Walden." Suddenly, from some bushes off the road, there's a cry.
"Help!
Roy exclaims, "What's that?" He reins in Trigger and wonders whether this is a trick or if someone is really in danger.
Someone in trouble?
I'm afraid the only thing to do is to wait until next week to find out.
Well, I hope that next week Roy does catch those two crooks and just fixes them good for what they did to him.
I feel the same way, and I think he will.
Good.
Now, how would you like to read Donald Duck?
Oh, I just love it, please.
Very well, then. Turn over the page, and there in the middle of page 7, under Barney Google and Snuffy Smith, is Donald Duckle, and I'll read him in just a moment. But first, here's that nice man again with something interesting to say.
Everywhere you go, across the country trip, or across the street party, you carry the fun with you when you own a Columbia Stereophonic high-fidelity phonograph. There's a marvelous selection of 7 new portable models in smart new color combinations at your Columbia phonograph dealer, from which you may choose. Each one is a masterpiece of design and beauty. More quality, more features, and more styling have been built into these sturdy portables than ever before. How much fun you'll have enjoying all the wonderful new sound of stereo records. Regular records take on new beauty, too, when played on handsome Columbia portables. You'll be amazed at the big console sound that is reproduced by Columbia portable stereophonic high-fidelity phonographs. You'll thrill to the excitement of Stereo One by Columbia, number one in the wonderful world of sound. And Columbia portables are economical, too. Prices start as low as $24.95. See them and hear them at your Columbia phonograph dealer.
Now, here we go again with Puck the Comic Weekly. And in the middle of page 7 of the first section is Donald Duckle, good for a chuckle. Say the magic words for the music with me. Squeegeum, squeegeum, chiddly chick chack. Let's have music to fit a quack quack. Donald turns on the radio, and a voice comes out.
"And now, Aunt Fanny's Personal Problems Hour."
Donald smiles and settles himself down to enjoy Aunt Fanny's personal problems.
"Good afternoon, folks. This is Aunt Fanny, all ready to solve your problems. And the first letter is from a young lady."
Donald smiles and says,
"Ah, a young lady."
And listens as Aunt Fanny reads the young lady's letter.
"Dear Aunt Fanny, my boyfriend is so stingy, he only takes me to the cheapest places. I'm desperate, Aunt Fanny. What shall I do? Signed, Daisy."
Last picture, top row, Donald exclaims,
"That rotter."
Then first picture, bottom row, his eyes pop together, and he exclaims,
"Daisy! Daisy!"
And he realizes that the letter is from his girlfriend, Daisy, that she's complained about him to Aunt Fanny. And he listens as Aunt Fanny answers Daisy's letter.
"Dear Daisy, on your next date, wear your oldest, most ragged clothes, and he'll get the idea."
Donald smiles to himself.
"So, a trick, huh? A female conspiracy, huh? Well, we'll see about that."
And in a minute, with a trick of his own in mind, Donald has Daisy on the phone and is asking her,
"Like to step out for chow tonight with me tonight, Daisy?"
Daisy replies,
"Oh, I'd love to."
Last picture, Donald dressed in his very best clothes, and Daisy dressed in her very worst clothes, enter a beautiful high-class nightclub.
Donald looks very pleased with himself, and Daisy looks very unhappy with herself.
What a problem.
And when the waiter sees Daisy, he looks just like this.
Oh, that was mean of Donald to take her into a nice place when she was dressed in old clothes.
Well, I think it was mean of Daisy to wear old clothes when she was going out with Donald.
Yes, but Donald had always taken her to cheap places. And when a man... when a man takes the girl to a cheap place...
Very well, then we won't read Blondie.
Oh, I'd love to have you read Blondie.
Oh, you changed your mind,
no,
huh?
No, I always love to have you read Dagwood and Blondie, and I know where to find them. Just pick up the first page of the second section of Puck the Comic Weekly.
Well, since you have it all spread out, I shall read Dagwood and Blondie. Ramafoo, ramafum, zim, zam, zombie. Conjure me music for Dagwood and Blondie. Herb Woodley's wife, in her bathrobe, has come over to Blondie's house, and she tells Blondie that Herb is working late, and she's scared to death in their house all by herself. Blondie says...
Oh, you're welcome to sleep here, Tootsie.
And upstairs they go. Blondie routs Dagwood out of bed and tells him...
Dagwood, you go downstairs and sleep on the sofa so Mrs. Woodley can sleep with me.
Dagwood climbs out of bed and goes downstairs. Last picture, top row, Dagwood settles down on the sofa. He yells,
Yellow!
Oh! The spring in this sofa is broken. It's cutting me to pieces. First picture, next row, Tootsie Woodley hands Dagwood a key, saying, Well, here's our key, Dagwood. Go next door and sleep in our bed. A little later, Herb Woodley comes home, saying,
Oh, man, I'm tired tonight. It's going to be good to get some sleep.
He goes right upstairs. Comes into the bedroom. Turns on the light. And looks at the bed. And his hat pops off his head. He exclaims,
Dagwood!
And Dagwood says sweetly, Oh, yeah, your wife is sleeping over at our house with Blondie. By the time that Herb has gotten his pajamas on, Dagwood is sound asleep, making a terrible racket. Herb says angrily as he looks at Dagwood,
I can't sleep with all that snoring. I'll go over to his house and sleep on his sofa.
Over at Dagwood's house, Blondie and Tootsie, who have let Herb in, watch him as he settles down on the sofa. Blondie tells him,
Herbert, you can't sleep on that sofa. It's broken.
Oh, you're telling me.
But Blondie solves the problem by saying,
I'll go over to your house and sleep with Dagwood, and you two can sleep in our bed.
But first picture, bottom row. No sooner have Herb and Tootsie settled down in bed, in Dagwood and Blondie's bed, than the five pups come into the room. Herb says, Uh-oh,
their pups are surprised to see us in Bomstead's bed.
Suddenly, the dogs begin to howl. Last picture, Dagwood and Blondie stick their head out of Herb's window and yell, Shut those dogs up, or I'll call the police. Herb and Tootsie stick their heads out of Dagwood's window and shout,
They're your pups.
And the pups stick their heads out of the window and howl and howl.
Wasn't that funny? Everybody was getting in and out of bed and sofas, and then they finally end up with Dagwood and Blondie in Herb's house and Herb and Tootsie in Dagwood's house. I think that's so funny.
Yes, it certainly is. Well, now, how would you like to hear Uncle Remus and his Tales of Bear Rabbit?
Oh, I'd just love to.
Well, goody. Turn over the page past Jungle Jim and to the top of page 3. And here we go with Uncle Remus and his Tales of Bear Rabbit. Say the magic words with me. Hippity-hoppity, make it a habit to give us music for old Brer Rabbit. Uncle Remus says,
One time Brer Coon's store was robbed, but the only clue was some great big footprints.
Yes, Brer Coon's store had been robbed, and right out in front, leading away from the open door, are big footprints in the mud. Brer Coon is telling the sheriff and Brer Rabbit,
Yeah, he busted in during the night, but he only took sweet stuff, candy and sugar.
The sheriff looks to where the footprints lead and says,
And the footprints stop at the edge of the brush.
Brer Rabbit scratches his head thoughtfully as he looks at the prints and says,
Now who can wear shoes that big?
And he thinks and thinks. Somewhat later, Brer Rabbit is out in the woods talking to two little lizards, and he's saying,
All I ask you to do, Brer Lizards, is to scout through the brush around here and see if you can find a pair of big boots.
And Brer Lizard replies,
Well, I think I know where them boots is.
And they point over in the bush. And Br'er Rabbit looks in the bush, and sure enough, he sees two big shoes under the bush. And as he takes them out, one lizard says,
"Ah, we see them here this morning."
And lizard number two says,
"Yeah, but who do they belong to?"
And Br'er Rabbit replies,
"I think I know too."
And then Br'er Rabbit has an idea. And by the time we skip to the next picture, Br'er Rabbit has given the two little lizards some instructions. And he's putting one shoe on one lizard's back and the other shoe on the other lizard's back. And Br'er Rabbit says,
"Now you two boys do just like I told you. No matter where he goes, you just keep following him."
And lizard number one says,
"You just sit back and do the looking."
And lizard number two says,
"Yeah, but let's go."
And down the road, the two lizards go, carrying the shoes on their backs. Of course, the shoes are so big you can't see the lizards under them. So it looks like the shoes are traveling along all by themselves, which, of course, is a very strange sight to see. First picture, bottom row, the two shoes come traveling down the road toward Br'er Bear, who is sitting on a log surrounded by cans of sugar and honey and candy, which he's stolen from the store. All of a sudden, Br'er Bear sees the boots coming toward him. He exclaims,
"Boots! Them boots, there's walking and I ain't in them."
And he gets to his feet and runs off down the road, hollering,
"They's chasing me! Help! Help! They's got gold in them! I confess this! I took them sweets! Save me from them boots!"
The last picture, he runs right into town and skitters up a lamppost. So scared is he. Br'er Rabbit lifts the two shoes off the two lizards and says to Br'er Bear,
"Br'er Bear, you tripped up on your own boots."
And Br'er Bear replies,
"I has been tricked."
And Uncle Remus says,
"Guilty conscience runs for confession."
Wasn't that a funny look on Br'er Bear's face when he saw the two lizards coming toward him?
Well, it certainly was, and I'm afraid Br'er Bear's conscience got the best of him.
Oh, I'm afraid so, too. I knew he was guilty.
Well, now I'm afraid I'll be guilty if I don't read Prince Valiant to you.
Yes, you certainly will be.
Very well, then. Turn over the page. Go past the Comic Weekly Club, which I'm sure you follow every day.
Oh, yes, in the daily newspaper besides the Sunday paper.
And go past the Lone Ranger, across the page, past Little Iodine.
Oh, you don't have to turn all these pages. Just go to the right to the last page. That's where Prince Valiant is.
Oh, yes. And here we are on the last page of the second section with Prince Valiant and the Days of King Arthur. Hecate, Breckett, Gray Malkin, and Quince. Music romantic for a fair, fair prince. After his battle with the bandits, in which he gave him a good whipping and set fire to their fort, Val meets some of the countrymen, good people who lead him to a ruined castle where a little old bald-headed man is found. His name is Sieur de Luc, who says,
Pardon the slight untidiness of my house, good sirs. I am seeking control of a monster who is boisterous at times.
Val looks at his small, hairless host. So this is the man those stalwart yeomen love and hold in such great respect. Sieur de Luc invites Val and his men to dinner. And last picture, top row, they dine in an unruined corner of the castle. Sieur de Luc tells him,
I am preoccupied with science, so I divided my land among my men and let them govern it in council. They do it better than I can. We all have greater freedom for our work.
And he goes on, first picture, second row.
I have a formula for arousing the energies of a genie. But so far, I have found no means of controlling him. Come, I will show you.
So they rise from the table and go to the center of the room, where there's a hole in the floor. The Sieur de Luc tells him,
Into this hole, I place the blood of a black rooster, so. A toad, so. And a broken wine jar, so. Now, on top of this, a bag of my secret powder. And then, chanting the magic words, Ooh, botheration, I roll in a red-hot stone.
They all look at the hole in the ground, wondering what the magic genie within will do. Suddenly, last picture of the row, the genie gives forth an ear-shattering roar, and an arm of flame hurls the stone skyward. There's an explosion as the stone shoots up. Everyone runs to hide, and a second later, the stone drops again on a table. The Sieur de Luc stands with folded hands looking about him with a serene look on his face, first picture, bottom row. Val gets to his feet. But it takes much longer to get Eagle, Rufus, and Young Arf to return from their hiding places where they had run in such a hurry. Last picture, as Val looks at the strange little man in amazement, the Sieur de Luc thumbs through a book as he looks at the castle, which he has ruined by his experiments, and he says,
I am slowly reducing the formula. Next time, I shall leave out the toad.
Well, what do you think of that?
What do I think? I think he must be crazy. Look at that place. It's a mess.
Yes, it is. A mess.
Do you think it will help any to leave out the toad?
No, the toad won't do any good at all because the toad isn't causing any of that trouble.
Well, then, why does he use it?
Well, in the old days, people used to believe superstitious things, that by mixing up such things as toads and the blood of roosters and mumbling strange words that they could perform magic, but it never happened.
No? Then what caused the explosion?
Well, if you come next week, you'll find out.
Oh, I'll be here.
Fine. Now, that's all the time I have, but before I go, here's that nice fellow with some more interesting information.
From coast to coast, Ford owners agree, the big new Ford brings you more for your money. More in comfort, more in performance, and more in economy. But only through personal experience can you appreciate the restful ease of Ford's famous midship ride and the luxurious comfort of Ford's non-sag, foam rubber cushion front seat. Only by driving this great car can you enjoy its smooth power and solid roadability. And only by getting the facts about Ford's economy can you understand that so powerful, so smooth riding, and so beautiful a car can cost so little to buy, to run, and to maintain. Find out how much it saves you. Yes, before you buy any car at any price, it will pay you to stop by your local Ford dealers. Take the wheel of the 100 horsepower V8 or its companion in quality, the 95 horsepower 6. Once you've driven it, you'll agree the new Ford is the one truly fine car in the low price field.
Well, honey, and all your boys and girls have got to go now.
All right, Mr. Tommy Bigby Man, but I'll be waiting for you next week.
Okay, that's a date, and a date with all your boys and girls. Be sure to meet me with a little friend, Miss Honey, next week when I read Puck the Comic Weekly. For I'm the Comic Weekly Man, the jolly Comic Weekly Man. I'll be back to read the funnies to you happy boys and honeys. Don't forget, boys and girls, see you all next week. Your friend, the Comic Weekly Man. The Jolly Comic Weekly Man.
The Golden Age of Radio on WMKY and Lon Clark as a Comic Weekly Man, first broadcast on October 29th, 1950. This has been the Golden Age of Radio, classic old-time radio programs from the 1930s through the 1950s. Material for this program provided by the Internet Archive, an online nonprofit library of books, movies, music, and old-time radio shows on the web at archive.org. Tune in again for the Golden Age of Radio next week at the same time and channel on WMKY at 90.3 FM and online at WMKY.org.